The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, it's nice to be here. It's nice to see everyone's faces this morning. So here in Silicon Valley, intelligence is highly valued, not to mention rewarded. And this can create a certain relationship to the quality of intelligence, whether it's positive or stressful. But the Buddha also recognized a certain kind of intelligence, and he was clear that it's something that everyone has. But he was quite specific about what he meant by this kind of intelligence. So in particular, we all have the capacity for knowing clearly what is happening in this present moment. We all have the capacity for investigating how things actually work in the universe and in ourselves. And we all have the capacity to choose to let go rather than to cling. These are aspects of Dharma intelligence, if you will, and we'll be exploring this today, the kind of intelligence that emerges from Dharma practice and how it can be used not only in our own life, but also to benefit others and to benefit the world. This is our exploration for today. So I'm proposing to do something of a grand tour of the Dharma path this morning. And so it might be something that's a little bit hard for the intellectual mind to completely take in, so I recommend listening also with your body and your heart. So a key part of walking the path is learning to see clearly. That's maybe quite a lot of it. So early on, that means overcoming the hindrances and at least diminishing the discursive thoughts that go through our mind, you know, the thoughts that are about having conversations with other people and planning things and going over the past and those kinds of thoughts. Maybe you know them. I know them. And the hindrances referred to are specifically the qualities of desire and ill will, which go through the mind, things we want and don't want, imbalances in energy like sloth and torpor and restlessness, also included in that is anxiety or remorse, and then doubt. So those are the main hindrances that we work with. So we can initially use our cognitive mind, our kind of intellectual or intelligent abilities, to help quiet these obstacles to clear seeing, the discursive thoughts and the various hindrances. So, for example, we can give our mind the task of noticing the hindrances. If you're going to think, pay attention to which hindrance might be there. The problem is not actually that these hindrances arise, because they will. It's really that they're not seen and identified. You know, when they're not noticed, then they can operate, you know, keep operating and keep operating. So there are some specific techniques offered in the Buddhist teachings around how to work with hindrances. And we can use our intelligence to remember those teachings while we're sitting, and also to apply them. So, for example, there is a sequence of things that we can do in the case of ongoing disturbing thoughts that are bothering us. And one of them is, some of them are actually kind of cognitive. One of them is to specifically reflect on the disadvantages of that kind of thought. So if you're having a repeated, so-called obsessive thought about something, it's considered valuable to actually bring to mind some of the disadvantages of thinking in that way, the ongoing restlessness, the way that it conditions your mind, the fact that it's causing tension in the body. Just bringing the cognitive mind to these things actually begins the process of helping to let go of those thoughts. So these kinds of reflections use the intellectual mind, and they're actually quite helpful. Another way that we can use our intellect in practice is to study the teachings of the Buddha. such as the suttas. It doesn't take a lot of brain power to do this because the Buddha actually spoke quite accessibly. That was his style, is that he spoke to farmers, merchants, cowherds, courtesans, anybody really. And the teachings reflect this connection that he was able to create with a lot of different kinds of people. And in a number of suttas to lay people, he prays learning as one of the qualities, which doesn't necessarily mean, you know, a lot of book study. There weren't books at that time, but learning in the sense of hearing the teachings, really taking them in, reflecting on how they apply in our life, whether they seem to make sense to us. This is all considered very skillful within Buddhist practice. You're not asked to accept anything on pure faith forever. So learning is an important quality to emulate and develop. There's one nice list that consists of things that we should cultivate in our friends. So find friends who do this. So these include faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom. If all of our friends had those, we would be in very good shape. So we can make our cognitive mind into a friend, a helper in the task of getting the mind to see more clearly. But to do this well, of course, the cognitive mind does need some nourishment, some support. It can't really do it only on its own. So, of course, there are lots and lots of good kinds of nourishment described in the teachings and that we can find in ourselves. But I'm just going to highlight three that I think are very necessary. And the first would be ethical conduct. So this is not everyone's favorite topic, but truly to see clearly, we need the mind to really have a sense of its own stability, its own interaction in the world in wholesome, non-conflicting ways. You know, we could think of it that way. So that there's a feeling that comes with that, a sense of accord or alignment that is necessary, actually, in order for the mind to settle down and be able to see clearly, and certainly for the mind to go further on the path into the qualities that the Buddha described, such as concentration and wisdom. It's really a foundation. And it's not meant to be something that ties us up or stresses us out. That creates more hindrances. Ethics really works when it's something that we do because we want to, because it feels appropriate and it feels aligned. And we can use a sort of an internal guide to that. There are qualities of the mind that know when things are going smoothly. A second very important nourishment is goodwill or metta, so the sense of connection with other beings. That's a very basic definition of it. A sense of not wanting harm for others, to want to be in alignment, to wish that others' lives would also go well as we wish that our own life goes smoothly. So this can be understood. I'm presenting it in a very cognitive way. This is for the cognitive mind, but you know that this goes very down deep into the being, into the body, into the heart. And we can start to feel into that, and that is actually a nourishment for this kind of Dharma intelligence that we're talking about bringing out today. Again, it doesn't have to be some kind of a stressful thing. I don't know about that person. I don't know if I can do it. That's all part of that discursive, hindrance-related thoughts. These are the quality of metta is something that is very natural, actually. It's fundamental to just having a sense of being alive. And when we can tap into that in a very natural way, it will support the integration of our system, the integration of the head and the heart and the body and the mind all together. So I encourage finding some way to connect with goodwill in any way that it works. Without doing this, it will be, again, very hard to settle the mind and to see clearly. And then the third essential support that I'm naming today would be confidence or trust. Some use the word faith. If that doesn't work, you can find another one of these other words. But the cognitive mind, in my experience, has a fair amount of anxiety. It is a little bit worried about whether it can really know everything, whether it knows everything right, whether, and it's, you know, it's possible to do Dharma practice from a place of logical acceptance. That's, I think, important, but it may not go deep enough to really see exactly clearly everything that's arising. And so I've found it essential to stay tapped into the part of the heart that is coming here that you can't quite explain why. You know, why do you sit exactly? Why do you come to the center? Of course, we're all going to be able to name some reason that we could. But I would suspect that in all of us, there's something a little bit that would be a little bit hard to describe cognitively. And, you know, if that's a little bit disturbing because we want to always know what we're doing, then we may not pay attention to that part. But it's important to actually know that that's there. You don't have to then talk about it or try to explain it. There are things that shouldn't really be totally explained. And I encourage, in the intimacy of your own practice, to feel what that is and call that your sense of trust or confidence. Don't worry too much about what it is. And that is also a nourishment. All of these things, I'm deliberately using the word nourishment so that when we tap into them, we won't be afraid that they don't sound like us or that they're something we need to just believe in or something that we need to define. Oh, let's go look up in the teachings where this is. These are the nourishments. So you take them in like you take in food. Once it's in, it's going to integrate, spread, give you energy. So just allow these things to be a part of your intimate practice. Take them in as food, as something that's going to spread throughout your body and mind, giving you what you need to do, the things that you need to do. So through our own cognitive intelligence that's supplemented by these other qualities, we can develop the foundation of seeing clearly. And so at last I'll give you a term for it, mindfulness and clear comprehension. These are the qualities that emerge from engaging with practice with these appropriate nourishments. So there are many descriptions of what a mind that is mindful and clearly comprehending looks like. I'll just read the one from the Satipatthana Sutta, using the first Satipatthana of the body. Satipatthana means establishment, the way that mindfulness gets established. Here, a practitioner abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. It's pretty straightforward and clear description of a mind that is ready to see clearly. And it's useful to turn over those words in the mind and really feel them in the body, see what they come to. So a mind that sees clearly is an intelligent mind. This is intelligence that everybody has. That's Dharma intelligence. It doesn't really have much to do with our IQ or anything like that. It has much more to do with meeting this present moment in a certain way that leads onward on the path. So everyone has this capacity to see clearly in that way. So then we can maybe ask naturally, what is it that's seen when we see clearly? What do we see? And again, there are lots and lots of things that we can see, anything in our experience of body and mind. But they all coalesce into some particular aspects of experience that we see clearly, and I want to talk about some of that. So this becomes the domain of what's called vipassana practice, which emerges out of mindfulness. So we're now entering into a kind of intelligence that gets to be less cognitive. It's much more in the body. It has also qualities to it that go a little too fast for the cognitive mind in some ways. It may be that mindfulness practice is a kind of enhancement of cognitive intelligence, and then vipassana practice means investigating more with our whole being, seeing more directly without so much coming in from memory and from thought. So it's maybe more intelligent than we can really imagine, this kind of practice that we're getting into. So what we see about experience in particular are the universal characteristics. We see that things are impermanent or inconstant. That's the quality of anicca. We see that because of that, they're inherently unsatisfactory for providing ongoing happiness. That's the quality of dukkha. And we see that they are not so personal. They are anatta, not self. And this is because that they are conditioned. They're interconnected in ways that are unfolding conditions. We see this more and more clearly. And as a person comes to have some clear understanding of these qualities in particular, of the anicca, dukkha, anatta, and conditionality, they often have a particular phrase that they say. They say, all that is of the nature to arise is also of the nature to cease. So the ordinary intelligent mind hears that and says, so what? So what? Everything that's of the nature to arise is also of the nature to cease. It doesn't sound that profound. We were looking for something a little bit more obscure, I think. At least the ordinary intelligence, you know, feels more bolstered by that kind of thing. But actually, this is much more profound than our ordinary thinking mind can really understand. You know, we understand it more with our Dharma mind. And it's actually the heart of the teaching at some level. It has interesting implications. The first one being that there isn't really a solution to dukkha in the world of inconstancy. If everything that is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease, any solution, so-called, that would arise will also not last. And we may have noticed this in our life, is that, you know, there are situations we're in and something arises that solves them and we feel, okay, I finally got it together. I finally got everything together. How long does it stay together? You know, then the next thing comes and it's a little bit disorganized again. So this is fine. It actually doesn't mean that we don't look for solutions. And they, of course, do come and we step into them and then, you know, see what that is. And then the next thing will come. It doesn't really change how you need to go about your day in a sort of an everyday sense. But the underlying understanding is that we don't need to grab on to any particular thing as now I've got it. The teacher Joseph Goldstein from IMS says that he's had the insight, now I've got it, about 10,000 times. So, you know, we can have that thought, but it's a thought and it will arise and pass. So, you know, another dimension of looking at things arising and ceasing is that it challenges the notion of what a thing is, actually. Everything will change eventually. Things that come into being will eventually not be. And even while they're here, they're not so constant and they're conditionally supported. So we can start to question the thingness of things. And that doesn't mean that I'm expecting that at any moment this glass is going to dissolve and the water's going to flow. Although that would be very interesting, wouldn't it? But I'm glad it's still here for now. But, you know, we can again reduce our tendency to really grab onto things as being so important and so necessary compared to, say, the quality of the mind or the quality of the understanding in this moment. Those are seen to be more reliable in terms of the path. And finally, there's an onward leading quality to recognizing impermanence, is that the mind, I've already started to describe it, it becomes disenchanted with believing in solutions and things and the solidity of how life seems to be at times. So we know that things will flow on, and that eventually creates a willingness to turn all the way to that which, you know, that which is not conditioned. Because there is a solution, actually. It's what that faith that you started with at the beginning is looking for. And it's not anything that ordinary intelligence can understand, actually. This is a quote from another sutta said by the Buddha. This Dhamma is profound, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, to be experienced by the wise. Unattainable by mere reasoning. So we use the cognitive mind all along the path. It's not something that we shouldn't use. But there's another aspect of knowing that we eventually make room for in our experience. So I said it was a grand tour. On this grand tour, we've seen how we can use our intelligence and cognitive knowing to help establish mindfulness, to reflect on the teachings. It prepares the mind for Vipassana practice, which starts to move into a kind of knowing that's less cognitive, that's more about direct experience. We cultivate qualities like investigation and wisdom and clarity of mind. And we see qualities like inconstancy and impersonality. And then finally, in the end, the logical or analytical mind is set aside in order to realize what the Buddha meant by freedom. And then we get it all back. We have our intelligence available. It doesn't go away, but it's a little bit different in a sense. Maybe through Dharma practice, what we do is we transform ordinary intelligence into wisdom. Yeah. So it's something that, when it's properly nourished, the kind of wisdom that the Buddha was talking about comes about, seeing things as they have come to be and responding well. It's actually very, very simple in the end, but it takes a lot of rigmarole in the mind, it seems like. So, you know, the wise person does what is good for herself, what is good for other, and what is good for both, and what is good for the world. That's another outcome of this. So a person who has this kind of Dharma intelligence that's been grown through practice can bring benefit in a lot of different ways, many different spheres of life. One of them is, you know, is the individual, ourself. We can continue practice, continuing to deepen the understanding of the teachings. Keeping the teachings alive here in the West is important. All of us who are doing that is useful for this society, which hasn't seen as much of these teachings as some other societies have. And then this kind of intelligence has great benefits in many other realms, specifically the relational realm. Imagine how much easier it is to relate to people when we don't see things as personally as we used to. And even if you've practiced not for too long, we can start to get a sense of that things aren't as personal as we thought or don't need to be as entangled as we were. It's fairly common for me to hear people say that after some period of practice, they realize that they want to have a different relationship with their friends. You know, my friends are gossiping all the time or engaged in a lot of argument, and I don't know, I've been sitting for a little bit of time and it doesn't seem that appealing to me. So there comes to be relational benefit almost immediately in the practice. We certainly can't do this just for ourselves, but we start to be, you know, a person who has a little bit more choice in how to form friendships and how to be in relationships. Now, some of our relationships are complex and are going to take our whole lives to untangle. I'm not claiming it gets easy immediately, but it's easier as things go along. And then there are a lot of very interesting benefits that come in the communal realm through practice. And, of course, we have communities like this. And there are many different types of spiritual communities. The Buddha, of course, founded a number of them in his lifetime. Groups of monks would live together. And there's a very interesting teaching he gave about qualities that make one a good community member. And some of them are unsurprising, you know, qualities of generosity and loving kindness and ethical conduct. These are natural and are well known. But he also said that a good quality is if you have some of this Dharma intelligence, and in particular that this makes a person less obsessed. Right? One of the issues in communities is people getting obsessed with certain things. And so, an ability to have some self-reflection and to not be quite as, not quite as obsessed about things really helps communities. And then interestingly, another quality said that's helpful for community is if people remember that even though their job is to look out for others and serve the community as part of their practice, those people who have Dharma intelligence never neglect their own practice in favor of only serving the community. So this also actually makes for a good community member, somebody who has the self and the other awareness. This is healthy, essentially. And then spreading outward, it doesn't only have to be confined to one's own community. Dharma intelligence serves society. Some fraction of people are going to become inspired and develop strong compassion that enables them to become leaders or other ways of creating change and bringing healing out farther in the world. You know, when our practice is sufficiently carried around with us, it becomes beneficial even in spheres that don't recognize, officially the Buddhist teachings or aren't about that. But nonetheless, it gets carried in the same way that, the Buddha walked around in his world carrying the Dharma with him so clearly. And there's a way in which our own practice can enable us to do that in some form. We'll see what inspires us, how that works for us. But there's really no way, I think, that this practice can just sit on the cushion and only be intimate. And yet the more intimate and the deeper it goes on the cushion, in reflection somehow, the farther outward it can go. So if your aim is that you want to go outward, I would say go inward. It works well. So we started by noticing that Silicon Valley values intelligence. This is like placing a seed on a pedestal. Dharma practice is what can grow that seed, of our initial cognitive intelligence into much vaster qualities, like mindfulness, like clear comprehension, like skillful investigation, and like wisdom. When it's nourished by ethics, by goodwill, by confidence. So this growth is something that we all have within us. And we grow to be something that can live truly intelligently, a life of clarity, of care, of ease, and brightness of mind, if you will. I think there's a lot of brightness that is not just the brightness of how smart we are. It's a brightness that we all have, a brightness that shines forth from those who are doing Dharma practice. Maybe you see it sometimes in people. And it's possible if we bring all of our head and our heart to our practice. So I hope that you'll be interested to develop your intelligence fully, to develop your intelligence all the way through your being and then out into the world. So these are my thoughts for today. I would welcome further discussion or questions. Please.
Kim, I wanted to thank you for your connecting anatta to just, as I understand it, not taking things personally. And I've heard the two, but I never actually put those two together that way. Thank you.
I'd really like to echo that. Some of the teachings on anatta, like go through all your bodily parts, is this self, is that self, or your possessions. And those all, as you were talking, I was going through some of those. And like my hair, is this personal? Is this like, is my hair a personal reflection on me? Or my clothes a personal reflection on me? And the word, just the word personal really really resonated with me and brought out a different flavor to that teaching that was meaningful. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Behind you.
I appreciated the idea of taking intelligence and bringing it into the service of a such broader and more deeper way on Dharma intelligence. And so it just kind of opened up a huge landscape for me. Thank you.
Thank you for your wisdom. I wonder if you might say a little bit more about the topic of moving outward. You'd said if your aim is to move outward, go inward. My experience of many people drawn to meditation is that they are drawn inward naturally. Mm. So can you speak to the benefits of going outward?
Mm. Yeah, maybe we should do in directions different than we naturally incline. Certainly it's possible to go inward and think that that's it, that somehow there's going to be something found there that will do it for me, and therefore, and then I can, you know, have a nice easy life after that. So that also doesn't really match my experience, but I think that there's a way in which going outward is something that is more like the way a light shines than something having to be pushed or gone out. So the light rays don't push outward at all. In fact, as soon as they hit something, they illuminate it, and that's it. So the outwardness in Dharma practice, I think, comes from turning on the light. And then there's this something that goes outward. But it's what goes out feels to me very light, very non-substantial in a sense. And somehow the ability to stay with that and actually spread it has to do with continuing to be soft and yielding on the inside. And so I haven't found good language, and this may be my own something to put more words to, but I haven't found easy language about going outward in a deliberate way that doesn't naturally bring in hindrances and challenges. So I would say shining outward through clear comprehension and staying with what is within. Does that help?
I think that's a beautiful articulation. I'm going to ask the question again, though, because I didn't quite answer it, which is, what are the benefits to the practitioner of allowing that light then to reflect outward?
I see. Yeah, it's another form of nourishment. You know, we might call it, I named three for inward practice, but there comes a point, you know, when we have this sense of impersonality that several people have alluded to, there's a sense that, you know, what's inside and what's outside are less different. The conditionality is really only conditions unfolding. And so there isn't so much a need to have a particular barrier. And in fact, if I'm working on my own suffering inside, there's less difference between my suffering and your suffering, right, if it's impersonal. And so there's a way in which, you know, what's the sutta that says, you know, by taking care of oneself, one takes care of others. By taking care of others, one takes care of oneself. So there's a way that the nourishment can come from everything, once everything has been seen clearly, that also becomes a form of nourishment. There's a hand behind. Oh, there's one here and one there.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed that and loved the idea of the nourishments for the mind. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the practices that cultivate that confidence or trust or faith. I feel like I have a little more sense of how to cultivate ethics and metta.
Okay, yeah. Various spiritual traditions will give many reasons for faith. You know, there's always a list, you know, contemplate death, contemplate, you know, reasons to really get inspired to practice. But I think there's no substitute for the one in your own heart in the end. And one practice that I find interesting is to sit and ask the repeated question internally, why do I practice? And it's not meant to have one answer, and please don't write them all down or anything. But, you know, if you ask that question, you'll get an answer. And it's fine. It's a good answer. And so whatever answer we get, though, remember there's no solution. So you just say thank you and then wait for a moment and then ask again, why do I practice? And there will be another answer. And it's not like that one's right and the other one's wrong. You have to worry about which is which. You just say thank you and then ask it again. And there will come a point, if you're really brave and keep going, there will come a point where the answer is not a word, but there's something. And I think that might be why we practice. And knowing that is really helpful.
Kim, you were so articulate and the conversation was so flowing. I enjoyed your talk very much. I want to go back to that point you made about Joseph Goldstein, who I admire so much, and the impermanence about, you know.
Now I've got it.
Yeah, but my question is more, I mean, one of the core reasons that I come here, as you asked us to reflect, is this idea that I was fascinated with impermanence. My question is, when Buddha was actually talking about it, was he saying it that, you know, I've been meditating and I have got this understanding that things sort of change always? Or was it trying to let the audience know that whether you're happy or you're sad, the whole idea is that things will change? What was the basis for it? Was it just an observation that was made? Obviously it is. I believe in it. But tell me a little bit more, because I thought you said something about it eliminates suffering, this idea of impermanence. And maybe I misheard that.
Impermanence has a lot of levels. So it does have the level in that anything that we notice is present will someday be absent. So if we're happy or sad, or, you know, this is the, this too shall change. Yeah? Common understanding in wisdom traditions. And then if we stay with this sense of things changing, not as an idea, but as an actual experience, we may find that at there's a certain substrate level where things really are changing. It's like you know, it's like sand flowing or a river, and to the point where it doesn't even make sense to try to hold on to it. We don't experience that 100% of the time, but feeling that a few times is very helpful. And there's a way in which then we don't even need the concept of change. It's only a concept because we see the time itself, which is the needed to understand change, is also invented. So all of these things, you know, all these, but the brilliance of the Buddha, I think, in pointing toward inconstancy is something worth noticing, is that almost anywhere you touch it, there's something useful. So we don't need to even have a, we shouldn't have a fixed idea about what change is. Right? So however it's manifesting for you is good. It's useful in some way. In fact, it's not a good idea to get fixated on the idea of impermanence. Yeah, is this starting to... Yeah, okay. Sure, feel free to, yeah. Okay, thank you.